Welcome to another episode of Stephen A's World, the podcast. Two of my guests this week can do something I love to do, just slightly a little better than me, and that's singing. We have gospel artist Kirk Franklin and country singer-songwriter Brandi Clark. Damn, they can sing. But first, the CNN's Don Lemon, who has a book out called This Is the Fire. We get into his book, why he decided to write it now, dealing with social injustice and what needs to happen to keep improving things. This is the fire. What did it mean? There you go. What did it mean to you? Why the title of this book, Don?
Yeah. So, Stephen, as you know, this is a book that it was, and the person that I was paying tribute to, and this is my old copy of The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin, with all of my notes in it from the 90s when I started reading them.
Yeah.
So this is the Fire Next Time. James Baldwin said in The Fire Next Time, God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water, the fire next time. After the events, a number of events that unfolded during the Trump administration, among them, very fine people on both sides, Charlottesville, Ahmaud Arbery in Brunswick, Georgia, Breonna Taylor, and then George Floyd. I said that this is the fire. We're in the fire now. This is the fire that James Baldwin was talking about. And that's why I wrote this book. I sat down, much as he did, in the beginning with a letter to his nephew. And I started with a letter to my great nephew down in Louisiana because I was in quarantine and I couldn't be with him. And that's how it starts. This was inspired by the events of the summer of 2020 and the death of George Floyd.
I don't knock you for that at all. First of all, there's nothing to knock. It's a great book. I'm very proud of you for writing it. But I do ask this. You talk about what transpired within the last year or so, and obviously the summer of 2020 and what that sparked. There were things happening for years. You can bring the Eric Garner. You can bring the Philando Castillo and others. You saw a lot of things. You've chronicled a lot of things. You've reported on all of these things on a daily,
right,
weeknight basis. Okay, so why is it that 2020 hit you so hard compared to those other things?
Because I think it was because we were all sitting at home in the middle of quarantine in a deadly pandemic. Not many people not knowing if they were going to see their loved ones again, if they were going to get COVID, if they had it, if they were going to survive it, if their loved ones were going to survive it. We had loved ones who died. And so we're all at home. We can't go anywhere. We don't know if we're going to have a job. Many people, we don't know if we're going to be able to pay the bills, pay the rent, the mortgage, take care of our families. And I think that people were more open and vulnerable then. Not to say that any of those things, to downplay any of those things, you're absolutely right. But one led to another. Yes, Philando Castile, that had an effect on me. And I write about some of those instances in the book. But the one that broke the camel's back was George Floyd, and watching someone with their knee on his neck for almost 9 minutes, and the lack of humanity in that. I was just so affected by it. I said, this is it. Okay. So many people had asked me to write a book over the years, and I said, not right now, not right now. But this was the one. This was just the one that really opened me up in a way that I could not do it.
Don Lemon, you were born and raised in Louisiana. You went to LSU. You've been an outstanding journalist for years. You've been hosting your primetime show on CNN. You've got millions of viewers, millions of followers. So many people respect the hell out of you because of the job you do on a night in, night out basis. With all of that being said, I'm imagining, based on what you've seen throughout your life, that even though we didn't see a knee on someone's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, there's no question about that. You've seen a lot. You've reported on a lot. So I ask you this question. The administration itself, meaning the Trump administration, how much of a spark plug was that for writing this book at that particular moment in time?
That was more than one spark plug. That was a couple of spark plugs. Because we, as I said initially, we had very fine people on both sides.
Yeah.
Listen, some of the things that you mentioned happened under a different administration.
Yes.
But this administration was not just coddling and cozying up to white supremacists, to neo-Nazis, to outright racists. They were promoting it. They were becoming the racist greatest imprimatur. They were giving them legitimacy. And as a journalist and as a man of color, I could not allow that to happen, having such a big platform. And so, again, Charlottesville had a huge effect on me. We forget about the death of Heather Heyer. We forget about the president making excuses for coddling and posing up and promoting white supremacy. So it was a number of different things. But yes, I've lived my entire life as a black boy, a black young man, and now a black older man. And I think that I have reached a position now of where I can speak from authority. The last particular administration, I believe, quite honestly, Stephen, I haven't always been perfect in my in my personal life, and I haven't always been perfect in my professional life.
None of us
have. I feel like the last 5 years honed me as a diamond and shaped me and gave me a will and the authority to be able to speak from the position that I'm able to speak from in this book now.
You speak with fervor. You speak with fervor. You speak with conviction, not just in this book, but also on television on a daily basis. I have to admit, watching you as often as I do, even though you're fearless in terms of the questions that you ask, the way that you probe things, there was a level of fear that I actually thought I saw watching you at times from the standpoint you were fearful of where we were going as a nation. I want to know, is that true? Did I read that correctly? And did that serve as a profound impetus for you writing this book?
There was, there's a fear of where we were going. And there was also an anger. One could not be a part of the events and part of this country and see the events that were unfolding under the last administration and not be angry. The demonization of people, the lack of humanity, the division, the exploiting the racism and the bigotry in this country, the sexism, the venom, the toxicity, the personal attacks, the attacks on institutions. Yes, I was angry and fearful about where we were going. And had it not been for the November election of last year, I'm not sure where I would be now. I'm not sure how angry I would be now. I'm not sure what you would see on television now, because I just didn't know where we were going. And I think most people are afraid that the racists and the bigots were going to take over, as they certainly tried to do on January 6th.
What kind of question, because obviously you dedicated and wrote about your nephews, your wonderful nephews in this book, True in Cairo. What kind of message do you hope that they take away from this book?
I just got, I just hung up, Stephen, before I spoke with you, with Trishard's mom, who is my niece. Trishard is my great nephew, and his stepdad. And they were in tears about the book. They just started reading it and the letter to True, and what I say about them. What I want to do, I wanted to apologize to him about the world that he was inheriting, because I wasn't perfect and maybe I didn't lead in ways that I should have led to make the world a better place for him. I wanted him to know that his blackness is beautiful. I did not always know that. I used to try to, as I write in the book, I used to try to relax my hair. I thought that my skin was too dark in the winter and too dark in the summer and too light in the winter. I was never that comfortable with myself. I wanted him to have an ease about his blackness and his beauty that I never had, and that he learned to master his manhood and his humanity in a way that I didn't. So that's what I want him to learn, that he is beautiful, that he is powerful, and that he is as deserving of this American dream as anybody else, especially as a descendant of slaves who built this country.
A lot of people would consider you powerful as well, and that you have something in common, but you do have something in common with one of the most powerful figures in the world of sports, because this is ESPN Plus. You know, we're gonna touch on sports in some capacity, Don Lemon, and where you have something in common with the reigning defending NBA champion and the greatest player in the game today, which happens to be LeBron James, is that both of you were attacked by former President Trump. He questioned your intellect. He called both of y'all dumb. He said those kind of things about you. I wanted to know what that experience was like for you, particularly being on TV at night and being attacked by the president in the fashion that you were at that time.
But let me just say this. I wanted to be informed and not inundated. And so I stopped following the president on social media a long time ago, because what he would say was drivel, and what he would do, there, he had an agenda behind it, And that was to demonize people who were like me. Most of the time, I didn't even realize that he was attacking me or LeBron until someone else brought it to my attention or asked me if I wanted to respond to it. And my response was always, Stephen A., was, I don't want to punch down. I'm not punching down. Now imagine a cable news anchor is saying he doesn't want to punch down to the person who holds the highest office in the land, because that person is toxic. That person was a bully. That person was elected to an office, I believe, on an electoral fluke and had no business being in that position. So why would I even respond to him, especially about something that LeBron James was doing, trying to put kids in school and educate kids rather than putting them in cages on the border? Who was the real idiot? And I think we know the answer to that.
Last question to you. I know how you want this book to move and affect your nephews. How do you want it to affect the rest of us? What do you want us to walk away from being affected by with this? This is the fire.
I want us to do the work. I want us to not just when there are flashpoints in there and things happen like George Floyd or Ahmaud Arbery or Breonna Taylor, where we all say, oh, my gosh, what are we going to do? And we give lip service. I want us to establish relationships so that we can be able to see and feel each other's humanity. When you establish relationships, you get to know people, you get to love them, you get to experience their humanity. It's very difficult to demonize them or put your knee on their neck for almost 9 minutes and rob them of their God-given right. And that's the right to be able to breathe.
This is The Fire by Don Lemon. Appreciate you, man. Keep doing it up. Proud of you. And by the way, you got through this interview with a lot of energy. I'm very proud of the energy, Don. I'm very proud of the energy.
I'm going off of your energy and a big cup of coffee.
Even there you
I'm
go.
I'm so proud of you, brother. You do. Thank you so much.
My next guest is Grammy-winning gospel artist Kirk Franklin. He's got a new podcast out called Good Words with Kirk Franklin. And we get into why he started a podcast and what he's hoping to achieve. It is an honor and a privilege to have you on this show, my brother. Kirk Franklin, welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
Man, do you know how big it is for me to be on this show with you? This is the top of the mountain, brother. Thank you. Allow me to be here with you.
Thank you, man. The honor is all mine. Good Works with Kirk Franklin. I really, really want to know, what the title alone, what does it mean to you? What are you trying to convey with this podcast? Talk to me about it.
Well, you look at all the bad words that we continue to hear in society, words like polarization, words like social injustice, words like racism. And so it would be a beautiful moment when you could have words like compassion, words like empathy, words like patience, words like humility, words like love. And so the podcast that I'm blessed to be a part of called Good Words with Kirk Franklin is I want to put good words in the atmosphere, because whatever you sow, you shall reap.
One could look at your history. I mean, 27 years doing what you've been doing at such an elite level. One could easily peel apart from that and say, hey, you've been doing this for the vast majority, if not your entire career. Yet there seems to be something inside of you that says this calls for those kind of words to be articulated and elocuted and disseminated now more so than ever before. Do you find that to be the case? And if so, specifically why?
Yes, sir. Because the medium of music only gives you a certain bandwidth to be able to articulate certain levels of truth. Some conversations have to be more didactic. And in that process, you have to be able to have these linear conversations with people that are in the lexicon of culture, that have a greater microphone to be able to talk about what faith means to them, how faith brought them over. Because one thing that can be a great unifier within society is when we start having the conversation is that all of us, Black, brown, white, whatever your skin color, we all come from the same Father. We all come from the same Creator. And so because of that, we should treat each other like family, because our Father's watching.
Do you believe that with a podcast, because as somebody who's done podcasts, has hosted radio shows, has hosted
a
television show,
I mean, you
just
have.
talking, and you kept them all. Well, thank you so much. But I got to ask you, do you believe that you've got a shot at reaching as many people, not just in terms of them hearing you, but feeling you the way we've spent decades feeling the power of the music you helped create?
As I pray so. Is I pray that I'm able to venture into your world, into your space, and have a spirit of humility and humor that will allow people to want to engage in somebody with somebody that's vulnerable. I'm going to be transparent about my failures, my mistakes. I want to try to make you to give you humor and hope at the same time, and make them synonymous to the conversation of, as human beings, we all deserve an opportunity at the table.
How much thought have you given throughout your career? How much thought have you given into sort of venturing into more traditional music genres as opposed to just gospel? Just stick it to the music portion of this all, because you've been doing gospel. Mm-hmm. But you know what? You've got a flair, a flavor, a style, a pizzazz to it, as far as I'm concerned, that elevated the profile of gospel greatness, as far as I'm concerned, okay? But I'm looking at it and I'm saying you could do a lot of different things in the world of music. Have you entertained that at all?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, man, God has been so dope for me, Steve, is that I've been able to speak to other genres of music while still being, you know, the Jesus kid, you know, and I'm super cool with that. As I'm mad cool with that, because I feel that my purpose on life is to be the manager and not the owner. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. As I'm God's billboard, and wherever he wants to put me up at, it's my job to display his love, his compassion, so that I pray that I can make the conversation of faith attractive to some people that have been turned off by faith, or people that have been let down by organized religion, as I hope that I can be this conduit of the heart of God and the hurt of humanity.
Do you feel that being that conduit is more needed now than ever before?
You almost made me cuss. Yes.
Okay. All right. Because I'm thinking along the lines of you doing interviews, and it's just like, listen, this is a sports show, but I talk to folks in pop culture. I'm talking to you now, and I'm imagining you're going to open your podcast world to just everybody. To just everybody that you, because you seem that inquisitive that you want to talk to a lot of people. Give me an example of the kind of folks that you would love to interview and sit down and rap to for a half hour, for an hour, or even longer, because you get to do that with a podcast.
Yes, sir. I've already interviewed Pharrell, Chance the Rapper. I've interviewed the Kelly Rowland from Destiny's Child. I interviewed Matthew McConaughey last night. I'm having broad conversations, and so I'm very grateful to be just chopping it up with people and talking about how faith brought them through some of the challenging times in their lives, how they are able to connect their faith even with their success. And so it's been a super dope conversation. I pray, if the good Lord is kind, I'm going to be interviewing Stephen A. Smith someday.
Oh, please.
And we're going to be talking about... So, you know,
are you aware of the impact that you have in the sports world? Because you had a fan in Cam Newton of the New England Patriots last season who was jamming at practice to your music. Are you aware of that at all? Have you heard anything about that at all?
Yes, sir. Many, many, many times. I also interviewed Chris Paul, as I just interviewed Chris Paul. Chris Paul was singing some of my songs yesterday on a GQ interview. I saw that Russell Wilson was telling his wife that he listens to my music before he plays his games. So I'm very thankful. Some of my closest friends are Deion Sanders and Emmitt Smith. And you know, I'm quite sure these are cowboy people. And
that's right. I won't hold it against you.
You have a fight.
I won't hold it against you. You're Fort Worth native. I won't hold it against you. I won't do it.
Yeah. So, man, you know, yeah, I'm very humbled. Listen, Stephen, man, I have to tell you, I'm so thankful that I'm part of just the journey of people, that when people are going through, that God has been so super dope to allow me to be a part of the soundtrack of people's ups and their downs and their struggles and their belief that there will be better days.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. You are a Fort Worth native, Fort Worth, Texas. Is that correct?
Fort Worth. Born and raised. Still live here. I still live here.
Let me tell you this. That's good. No state income taxes. That's not a bad thing. But let me say this to you. Let me say this to you, sir. As if I needed another reason to have love for you, there's another one. I heard that you're right outside of Dallas, but you're not a Cowboys fan. You actually root. You have another football team that you root for. Is that true?
You're going to get me in trouble with the people here, man. I'm about to.
Come on now. They're not going to harm Kirk Franklin. They ain't going to do that.
I love Kansas City, man. And I'm a big fan of Kansas City right now, man. All right. I think that they are an incredible team. I think that young quarterback is super dope. But I always have a place in my heart that if we can get our stuff together, the Cowboys will be able to win my heart again someday.
Hey, listen, there's hope for everybody. There's hope for everybody. And put it to you this way. Even I liked the Cowboys when Prime Time and Michael Irvin and Troy Aikman and Emmitt Smith was there. Even I liked them then. Yeah. So it's all right. It's okay. Listen.
Thank you, sir.
All the best to you. I'm proud of you. I'm happy for you. Thank you so much for the decades of greatness that you've given us all. And you continue to be in my heart and everybody in the world of gospel and beyond, I'm quite sure. All the best to you, my brother.
And same for you. Same to you, man. Congratulations on all the great things from you starting just being on the radio to just being this now media juggernaut. Man, it is so dope watching you, man. Congratulations, King.
Last but not least is country singer and songwriter Brandi Clark. You name the artist, she's worked with them. We get into her singing career, her love for basketball, and much, much more. Thank you so much for being here. Now, and I want to ask you that you've described your Grammy-nominated album, Your Life as a Record, as your most personal album. What was the experience like for you to make such a personal album? Can you talk about that for a second?
You know, it was really freeing. I haven't, all of my records have felt personal, but this one really did. I had gone through the breakup of a long relationship and didn't realize I was even writing about that until I sat down to make this record with Jay Joyce, who produced it. And he pointed it out to me, said, this is a record. And so then I just kind of owned it. And we did some things that I haven't done in the past. Like we used the Memphis strings and horn section players. Mm-hmm. And that gave it a whole different feel than anything I've ever done. And probably something I'll want to do again and again and again. It was amazing.
You know, I recall reading with Jay Joyce, your producer, you just brought him up. You talked about in an article, it was saying, hey, he was telling you to be not as hard as you normally are, or it won't come across as sexy. He was trying to dissect it in that regard, and you gave him a lot of credit for really highlighting how you were coming across. How did you feel you're coming across when you do a lot of these records, when you perform them the way that you perform? When he says something is hard as opposed to sexy, I was really interested in that. I was like, wait a minute here. Excuse me, she seems to be very soft, very mellow, very nice. What do you mean hard by that? What did you take from that advice he gave you?
Well, I think he probably gave me a lot more years of singing when he said that, because mm-hmm. what it was specifically about was the song Love is a Fire. And I wanted to sing that song really big and be this great big singer on it. I'm not really a big, big singer. And he just said to me, you know, this song is sexy. And so I want to hear you almost whisper in my ear. I don't want to hear you sing at me. I want you to sing to me and use the microphone. He said, you know, it's there for a reason. And it really helped me. It's still, we haven't done a ton of live performing since this mm-hmm. record's been out because of been in, but the little bit that I've done, I've noticed a big difference. So it was great advice.
Now, what do you mean when you say you're not much of a singer? Because the Reba McEntires of the world and others, they don't say that about you. They consider you an absolute genius. Whatever you touch turns to gold in their eyes, based on everything that I've seen they've had to say about you. What do you mean when you say you're not much of a singer? Explain that.
Well, I guess, you know, I shouldn't say that. That's really not a good self-deprecating comment. I think what I mean is when I think of a great big singer, I think of like Aretha Franklin and Linda Ronstadt, And I'm just not that kind of a singer. I've always wanted to be, but I'm just not. And so when I'll say, oh, I'm a singer with a lowercase s, but maybe it's somewhere in the middle. You know, it's just finding. Yeah. I think I'm a great singer. Don't get me wrong. I think I have great tone and great pitch. I just don't. I just wish I could belt a little more. You know, but we all, you know, we all have what we have.
Do you feel you have what you have when you just say that? Because I'm thinking along the lines of sky's the limit with you. It almost seems that the special part about your career, just reading up on it and studying it over the last couple of days, is that it almost seems like you're just really getting started. Even though you've been around for a while, you just seem to be ascending, finding yourself more and more as the days and the years go by. Do you find that to be the case with you, or do you believe you're a finished product? You are what we see right now, and this is what it is.
Oh, no. I'm always evolving. And okay. I love that you see me that way, because I see me that way as far as just getting started. I feel really fortunate in that I had a long career as a songwriter before I ever made a record. Mm-hmm. And then it was like I was brand new again. And even on this record, like I said, it's more personal. There are more first-person songs than I've ever done. Lenny Warnker, who I work with at Warner Brothers, said to me, this is the album where you really became an artist. Mm-hmm. And so that's exciting to me, to be this far into my career in life and still becoming something.
Listen, one of the things I'm also curious about when it comes to you is that you've been very, very open, you know, being openly gay and what have you. And I wanted to know what kind of challenges, if any at all, do you believe that that has posed for your career? I don't imagine, I don't want to say whether I imagine or not, whether that has been an extreme challenge, because you seem to be somebody that just overcomes one obstacle after another, whatever they may be. But was that an obstacle for you, being open and being honest about your own sexuality?
It was an obstacle inside of myself only. Mm-hmm. I've never felt it be an obstacle from anybody on the outside. You know, I think I was afraid that it would be. And I love what you said about how I'll just find my way around it. If it was or is an obstacle, I don't know that. I just try to take the next step forward and go through the doors that are open to me. Now, I don't know if some of those doors that have been closed to me are because I'm openly gay, but if they are, then I'm not meant to walk through them, because I really have to live my life in the light and in the truth.
Brandy, that's an inspirational message that anybody can take from all walks of life and really use it to inspire them and motivate them to help them ascend to new heights. I'm wondering, when you contemplate or think about some of the challenges that you have faced as you've now moved forward and you're clearly in the spotlight as one of the elite at what you do, what kind of advice do you think that you can espouse and put out there for others to follow that you think can serve as a strong source of motivation and inspiration for them moving forward based on what you've already achieved and what you've had to endure in order to achieve what you have achieved in your life?
You know, I think the biggest piece of advice I could give, I actually saw this written in a bathroom stall, and I'm sure somebody great said, but it was written in a bathroom stall and it really stuck with me years ago. It said, be you. Everyone else is taken. And I think that's the greatest piece of advice I've ever seen. And I would say be the greatest you can be, so that those things that might feel like an obstacle about yourself aren't, because your art is just so great that there's no keeping it down. That's what I try to aspire to.
Now, again, I do my homework, Brandy. I do my homework. And a little birdie told me in my research here that somebody had fantasized about being the greatest women's basketball player ever. And that person was you. Is that true? Is that true?
That's 100% true. In fact, I have a funny story. I dreamed as a little girl, I grew up in Washington State, of playing for Pat Summitt.
Wow.
I was never great enough to play for Pat Summitt. But I really, if I would have had as much talent athletically as I had musically, I probably could have. But basketball taught me that discipline, you know. But I always, you know, dreamed of being a lady volunteer. Fast forward decades later, I'm on the road with Eric Church, and we're playing in Knoxville. And somebody gets a hold of me and says, hey, Holly Warlick, who was then the head coach of the team, is a fan of yours. She heard you used to play basketball. She wants to invite you to a practice. And so I go and watch them practice. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, if my 16-year-old self knew this moment, she would just be beside herself. And I was beside myself as my adult self. So, yeah, and I'm still a huge basketball fan. I live for March Madness every year. And I'm so glad that it's going to happen this year.
Now, as the sports guy here, Brandy, here's the deal. The great Pat Summitt, and we knew and we all know what an iconic figure she was at the University of Tennessee and all those championships she's won and what have you. She was hard-nosed. She was hardcore. Would she have broken you? I mean, could you? I mean, you had an athletic scholarship to Central Washington. We know that you got a little ball in your history. We get that. But Brandy, I mean, she was the kind of person that could break you down to lift you up.
Oh,
do you think that would have happened with you?
100%. She would have completely broken me down and hopefully lifted me up. But yeah. Oh, and I would have subscribed to everything she told me to do, so it probably would have worked. I just didn't have enough talent to really cut it at that level. And honestly, by that point, the music bug had bit me so hard. It was sort of starting to, sports were taking a back seat. But yeah, that was a dream.
Thank you so much for being on the show. All the best to you. Wishing you good luck. All the best to you. And thank you so much for being a part of Stephen A's World. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Big thanks to all my guests this week for opening up to me about important issues. And remember, if you want the full Stephen A experience, you need to head over to ESPN+.